Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. We are once again honored today to have on with us our special guest, Mariam Jacobs, psychosocial therapist and BA philosopher from the Netherlands. Mariam is back to speak about incarcerations, the causes and comparisons between prisons and prisoners, Mariam's experience in the prison system with restorative justice, her vision on the approach of incarceration called deeper justice, her insight into what led to crime, and finally, discussion about her upcoming book to be announced soon. She will also be talking about today, which is very vital information for all of us, and that is the Eighth Amendment. And I am so thrilled to have on with us again our friend and guest, Mariam Jacobs. Mariam, are you on with us? Mariam?
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. How are you today?
I am very fine, thank you. But
I
can hear you, but it's very soft.
Okay, I'll see if I can improve that on this side with the volume. But ma'am,
yeah,
you want to speak a little bit about yourself again?
Yes, I am Mariam Jacobs from the Netherlands. I work in my country with restorative justice in prisons, and my focus is on meeting the human being behind the crime, and I call that deeper justice because what the goal is that incarcerated people have the possibility to do justice to themselves on a deeper level. And it means that incarcerated people get a chance to get to insight in the events in their lives that happened, that led to the moment they committed a crime. It also leads to insight in who the person was at the moment he committed the crime and what the crime itself is telling him. And all this information leads to healing inside and rehabilitation of the human being. So that is what I do. And I do this because I believe that restorative justice between a victim and an offender only can take place after the offender has healed himself first and has found his humanity back in himself.
And the reason I was so impressed with that, Mariam, is because there are so many people incarcerated in this day and age, and it's been throughout the years, but there are so many people that have been incarcerated that people do not look at the cause. They look at the individual, as you mentioned in one of the previous interviews. And this is something that's very important because there are so many different reasons why people commit crimes. And prisoners are always stereotyped. And they're also targeted. A lot of prisoners are targeted. And their lives are made more difficult while incarcerated because of that. So when you speak of restorative justice, it is possible in many cases for the victims and the prisoners, the offenders, to be able to work things out with mediators involved. But there are also individuals, in my personal philosophy, is that there are also people that have, again, caused someone to fall. And the very people that have caused it are going to be the very people that most likely would not want to, you know, be in a program like that. But I wanted to hear more about what your thoughts are on these issues and also the Eighth Amendment.
Yes. I am doing research for my book, and I also did research on the amendments. It started with the 13th Amendment, and then I came to the 8th Amendment, and the 8th Amendment says that cruel and unusual punishments are forbidden. The 8th Amendment also says that treatment of people incarcerated, but that starts already when someone is not yet convicted, but is only accused of something. He always has to be treated with human dignity. And to me, it was very surprising that a country has this amendment, the Eighth Amendment, and at the same time, it houses 2.2 million people in prisons in very bad, inhumane circumstances. The pitfall of the amendments are, of course, mostly based on values. So the terms inside the in the amendments are very easy to interpret on different ways, and it's necessary. It's a part of democracy because terms like dignity, like punishment, etc., change during the time. Sometimes issues in society can be accepted by society, and maybe 10 years later they become a political issue. So on one side, it's very important, and it's a sign of democracy that the amendments are can be interpreted on different ways, so people keep debating on them. At the same time, I also see this very this line between mass incarceration and the Eighth Amendment, because sentences like life without parole are cruel and are inhumane, and the whole system is, in fact, inhumane. Solitary confinement, it's proven that it damages the brain. It's scientific proven, so we cannot lie about it or explain it on a way that would benefit people, because it's simply proven. Still, it's going on. And that surprises me a lot, because it's a very big contradiction between the amendment and mass incarceration.
We have so many law firms, so many civil rights organizations in this country, and it seems to me that so many people who are so much in need of their help, because they're not only their civil rights, but also their human rights are being taken from them. And a lot of these law firms, these civil rights organizations, these lawyers will deny them the help. And I don't understand how this can be in this country. Also, there's been a lot of suicides or alleged suicides in the prisons in the United States, a lot of them. And I know that many of them are actual suicides, because I don't believe prisoners can cope with the torment and the torture that they are put through, whether it be physical or psychological torture. But I think there's a lot of them that are alleged to be suicide where they're not. And this is another issue. Again, I started this petition to replace prisons or to convert prisons into long-term residential treatment facilities rather than prison settings, and bringing in people like yourself, psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers, occupational speech and physical therapists, medical doctors and nurses. This is so vital to help our people that are in prison across the world, really. But the United States is the one that has mass incarcerations, not other countries. And we spoke a little bit about that as well. But the prisoners in this country are being overseen by other people that are just as bad, that are criminal-like, that are criminal-minded, that are inexperienced, uneducated, and anyone off the street can get a job as a correctional officer. But to really rehabilitate and help these prisoners to heal, it's people like yourself that are needed most in the prisons. And when they contract out with other providers, the providers that go into those prisons, the medical or psychological, they go into those prisons, they become employees of the Department of Correction. And even though they may diagnose someone with a disability or a need to have surgery, if they are overwritten by the Department of Correction officials, they won't pursue it. And that person will remain sick, mentally or physically. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, if I come back to the Eighth Amendment, it also says that people incarcerated always have the right to access to health care, have the right of proper treatment. They have the right to proper food and all that. So that's against what's happening in practice. And sorry, what you mentioned about staff that seems to act in a revenging way to incarcerated people. I think that there are staff members, guards, who abuse their own ability to make use of the power of the uniform, the badge, the spray they have in the pockets. And there are guards who take that job because they can take revenge on their own old issues they have never worked through. You know, I think if you become a guard or on another way you start working with these people, you first have to get to know yourself more. In fact, these people also should go through a process of deeper justice before they treat the vulnerable people in prison. So what I see is that the system itself, and that's what I see also in the research I do for my book, the system itself is sick, and it's based on, well, I call it the evil systems. There are mechanisms in the system that makes this possible, because that's my big question. How is mass incarceration possible in a democratic country, in a Western country? And what makes it going on? What makes it so difficult to reform? Who benefits from it? And I'm not only talking about the million-dollar industry. We know that that's also the case. But I also think about other social issues where the system is embedded in, like in there are villages, mine villages, former mine villages where the mines are closed. The father worked in the mines, the grandfather worked in the mines, etc., etc. The mines got closed, a prison got built, and people had a job again. But choosing to work inside a prison with the imprisoned people should be a very conscious choice. People should be screened before they are allowed to work in the prison. But a lot of people, they simply do it because they have a job to make money. You know, you can work in a factory to make money, but you cannot work with people only to make money. And because then it becomes dangerous, and that's what you see inside the prison.
I think a lot of times people are hired for jobs because of someone they know, someone in a higher power that wants to give a friend or a family member a job, and they do it without having any qualifications. One of the things is we find in this country is that these people in prison, when there's a riot that breaks out, automatically they focus on the prisoners. There was a riot that broke out in January 10th, 2020, where some guards, correctional officers, were attacked by some prisoners. They transferred those prisoners out of that prison, and then they went on an unprovoked attack on all other prisoners who had done nothing wrong. They sprayed, pepper sprayed them, mazed them. They beat them. They brought in the dogs. They put them in solitary confinement. These are people that did not do anything. But this is the mindset of the prison officials and the guards. There are some prisoners right now who have lawyers that are filing lawsuits against these prison officials and the department because of the abuse that they did to these innocent prisoners. There's a prisoner that they put, not only did they handcuff him with a torn rotator cuff, but they put him in on a restrictive block, which they claim is a general population block. But they took all of his belongings. They kept his television. They kept his Bible. They kept his clothes. They kept his sneakers. They kept his bathrobe. They kept his legal documents. They gave his law books to the prison library. This prisoner has been in a cell for the going on 11 months now with no belongings whatsoever. In his cell 22 hours a day, 2 hours out each day. An animal gets more time out of a cage. These are the things that go on in these prisons today. This is a violation of not only the civil rights, but also the human rights. And yet the lawyers who are working with those prisoners who were sprayed, who were beaten, and some of them even ended up in the hospital, broken legs, broken arms. It later came out that those guards that were attacked by the prisoners were causing these prisoners, they were provoking. And when the prisoners asked that those guards be removed, the prisoners were told they were going to have to deal with it, and they dealt with it. But it didn't mean that all the prisoners after that, that had nothing to do with it, had to go through this trauma. And this is the mindset of these people who are placed in positions, as you mentioned, working with people. They need more education, they need more training, and they need to be evaluated to see if there's any kind of racial injustice going on as well.
Well, what I hear is, and what now comes up in me is that in prison, staff approaches labels, and it means that the approach is systemic. It's not individual, it's systemic. So what they do is, what you mentioned, that riot, they approach everybody on exactly the same way. Innocent, guilty of this riot, it doesn't matter. Everybody gets exactly the same treatment. That's the greatest problem inside the system. The guards are trained to systematically treat everybody on exactly the same way, whether it's human or not human. So the individual approach that you explain, because you look at it and you explain what's happened, but you do it from a human view, an individual view, and you see that people are mistreated, people were innocent, and they got punished anyway. And there you see a very big gap. There are the people who look at this, at incarceration on a human way, and they say, okay, people are incarcerated. And the question is not if people have to be incarcerated, but how, you know, that they get treatment, that they get rehabilitation, et cetera, et cetera. But what you see in the prison is that everybody who has to do with the prison, the staff, the incarcerated people themselves, it's all systemic. And that to do so and to keep mass incarceration under control, they dehumanize every person who enters the prison from day one. They have to give up their personal clothes. They have to give up, well, not literally, but symbolically give up their name, and they get a number. So they become the label inmate. And when you label a person, then you dehumanize him, and then you can cross that line of humanity. Because in the free world, a correctional officer would never treat his neighbor as he treats the inmate, because his neighbor is a human being and he sees the inmate as a label. And that's the big danger. The whole thing, what you're explaining about what has happened, and is all systemic thinking and human thinking, human approaching, individual thinking is absent in prison. And that makes mass incarceration so very dangerous. There are also CEOs who have never had training. They have only had high school. And then they can become a CEO. See?
Yeah.
So that whole human element has been taken out of the prison. And that is the underlying reason why all these things happen. And it's a cheap way. If for the people, the organizations who benefit financially, it's cheap, to have 2.2 million labels because you can treat them all in the same way. You don't, diversity costs money, and homogeneity, I don't know how to say it in English, but the label is cheap. So it's also a picture of money. And when you look at the CEOs, it's an easy job to do. You can do it without training because you don't have to do so much. You don't need to think. The CEOs are also functioning like robots. It's all mechanical. There's no human element in it. And that makes it a very dangerous place to be.
You're right about that.
You are very far away. Can you put the volume a little bit harder? Because I cannot hear you.
Okay, the volume is up as high as it can go, Marianne. Can you hear me?
Yeah, it's very softly, but I will try.
I have the speakers up as high as it goes, so I don't know if it could be at your end too.
Okay, say it again, please.
I have the speakers up as high as they will go. Is it possible?
Yeah.
Could it be at your headphone?
No, I've tried it with listening to music, tried it, and the music was very loud, so it's not on this end. But I can hear you. I concentrate and then I can hear you.
Okay, I'm trying to see if there's any way I can make it even louder, but I don't know. No, it's as high as it can go.
Oh.
The volume.
No, okay, but I can hear you. I can hear you.
Okay, I'll try to speak a little bit louder.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, okay.
But what I was going to say is, there's a lot of these. You mentioned something about the wages of correctional officers. They're not that great, but at the same time, I notice what's happening too. Is there is a lot of drugs being brought into the prisons in this country. And if you go on the internet and just type in "God's caught smuggling drugs into the prisons," you'll see so many of them that are doing this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things is when family members and friends go to visit their loved ones, which they haven't done for months because of this pandemic, but when they go to visit their loved ones, they're the ones that are spoken of in the media as the possibility of bringing in drugs to the family members or friends. And to me, it's more so coming in from the employees of the Department of Corrections rather than the families and friends of prisoners. This is a major issue because another thing I wanted to bring up as well, when you mentioned dehumanizing prisoners, is that a lot of prisoners don't even know the first names of another prisoner because they're labeled by their ID number or their initials, the initials of their last name or whatever. I also notice now when you go on an inmate locator on the internet looking for an inmate, they have taken away the inmate's race so that they have unknown for a person of color. And a lot of these inmate locators are no longer mentioning the inmate's race unless it's Caucasian. And this is another issue I'm finding that's going on in this country. And these are some of the things. There's such a combination of all these things that are occurring. It's a racial thing. It's an abuse. It's targeting prisoners. It's befriending prisoners to get them to sell the drugs that you bring in, the employees bring in. there's a lot of things that go on in the prisons, and there's so much to talk about. And that Eighth Amendment that you mentioned, when I thought about that, when I heard you speaking about it, it really made sense that a lot of the abuses that go on in the prison are probably favors being done. God's having prisoners who are receiving the drugs or selling the drugs, doing favors for them if they have a problem with another prisoner or other prisoners. This is another thing that happens a lot of. Innocent prisoners or prisoners that are just trying to serve their time without incidents are the ones that are being targeted sometimes. For whatever reason, it could be outside connections or whatever. And it keeps bringing me back to your book, your philosophy, and when we speak about it, deeper justice. Deeper justice, there's so much more to a situation than a lot of people realize.
Yes, what I see in the system is that a lot is hidden. It's a mystery, and that's what you see with evil systems like mass incarceration. The bureaucracy is very huge. Maybe people don't know, are not really aware of the Eighth Amendment. Sometimes people manage to get to a Supreme Court to fight for the case in the light of Eighth Amendment, but that's not many times. And that's a shame, because it should be much more possible to do so. What you say about the drug problem, the contraband problem, yeah, it's also a system inside the system, the economic illegal system inside the system, and that's also maintained because, what you said, guards don't earn a lot of money, so they can use more money with illegal stuff. And what you also see with a lot of CEOs is that they have some idea of doing a heroic task by working as a CEO. So I think that a lot of CEOs have their own self-esteem issues, problems from their youth, which they have never processed. So they still keep, what I said, they still keep taking revenge on the prisoners to get rid of their own aggression. And to society, they have this feeling that they are a hero, because at the end of the day, when they have survived their shift, they go home and they have this feeling that that day that they worked, they have kept the society safe from crime, which is all nonsense, of course. It makes absolutely no sense. And all these thoughts are so far away from rehabilitation. You know, when you look at systems that do work, and there are not so many, Norway is, of course, the famous example. In the Netherlands, we are working towards it. Incarceration should, in fact, in the very first place, it should be focused on the offender, the incarcerated human being who tries to remember who he is as a human being. He has to remember again who he is. And it's such a simple question, but it's a process question. And the things that you describe are so far away from that goal. You know, rehabilitation is almost absent. There are, of course, groups, there are people who do very good work in prison, but that's too less. It should be organized by the justice system. But instead of that, people are transformed into labels, and money is made out of the system. There is a lot of benefit for a lot of parties who are involved in it, and people, too many people, choose to keep their eyes closed for what is happening, and that's a shame. That's a real shame.
I will agree with you on one thing. There are good correctional officers. I know that for a fact. But the problem is these correctional officers are so afraid to speak out against their peers. I think maybe because of the union, because they now, the Department of Corrections across the country has such a powerful union that the good guards, the good correctional officers and officials are so afraid to speak out, which is a shame, because as long as they keep quiet, other prisoners believe if you don't speak out, even though you're a good person, if you don't speak out, then you're part of the problem. And it's like a catch-22. They don't know what to do. I am in favor of defunding the Department of Corrections. I am in favor of cutting down on their budgets, because that money is also going to their unions, and that's where the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Well, and one universal element what you see in evil systems like mass incarceration, that it is based on fear. Fear keeps mass incarceration going. Fear within the incarcerated people, but also fear of COs who do want to have a change, who do want to do it differently, and cannot speak up because they fear. Fear is very important element of the way mass incarceration functions, because that's what I'm looking at. How does it function? Because if I have an answer on how it functions, then I also get more of an answer of what is the goal of it, who benefits from it, and why is it so difficult to transform it. Another very important thing is that labor work is, and it's also what you see with COs, work is cut into very small tasks. People who, you also see it in Amazon. Amazon is a very interesting example. It functions also the same way. When people get only little tasks, universal little tasks, they don't feel responsibility for the organization. That's what you also see with COs. They have no overview of their organization. They are not connected to the organization. They are like robots who do their job. That's what you see in mass incarceration. It's very important to see that, because that's another element of the way evil systems exist. Responsibility is taken away from incarcerated people, and responsibility is in a way also taken away from COs, because they only do their task and they have no overview on the organization where they work for. You know, if I work in an organization and I know that organization, then I go for it. I have spirit to make, to develop myself, to contribute to the organization. But what you see in a prison system that functions the way it does in the United States, that's all gone. That's all absent. So what you see is that people only do that little task they have to do every day, every evening, you know, and they are not really committed to it. You cannot be committed to mass incarceration. So you see what all is missing. Humanity is missing. Individuality is missing. Commitment is missing. Responsibility is missing. Empathy is missing. I have only mentioned five things, but they are huge things that are all missing, and that makes mass incarceration into a factory instead of an organization where people can rehabilitate. Mass incarceration is a factory. It produces labels. That sounds very hard, but it is. And what I said last week is torture makes money and emotion makes money. Families have to pay a lot of money to get connected to their loved ones, so it's big business. And that is awful. I have no good word for it. It's awful to think about that torture makes money, hunger makes money, because if you starve, incarcerated people. They have to go to the families for extra money for commissary to buy extra food. It makes money. Starvation makes money too. And we have to realize that this is happening now in 2020 in a Western democratic society.
I totally agree with that. And I will say, if you, well, you probably have seen this, but when we watch television these days, anything that's violent, anything that's inappropriate is what everybody is looking to watch. And these producers know this. They take the blood, sweat, and tears of other people, unfortunate situations that go on in the world, and they put it on in movies and on TV. And this is how they make their money. And it's sad. It's, we see so much war going on. We see so much injustice around the world. We don't need to see it in a movie or on a television show. But this is where they get their, this is where they get their money. This is where people go to see all this. When in fact, that's, I think that's one way that they are just increasing the violence and the injustice that goes on in the world, because they're living it, they're focusing on it, they're watching it. Everything around them is evil. Everything around them is injustice. Everything around them is greed. Everything. And these people are making money on these types of shows. I noticed when something happens in other countries, it's mentioned once or twice in the media, in the news, and then it's forgotten, or it's, they move on. In the United States, when something happens, they will talk about it almost every day, and then it'll stop for a while and then come on a month later. They just keep focusing on these same issues. People cannot move on if these things are happening, and this happens too much in this country.
Yeah, and I think what you also see, and that's maybe something also in this time, you see it in the world, is that there is no much room anymore for being authentic. It's like societies are more and more becoming systemic. And what you see is we are comparing ourselves with other people, and then we have to get better. We want to be, we want to have status. We, our egos are blown up, are growing. What you see, also what you see, and that's very scary, is when you do not fit society, then you are out, then you are excluded. People get excluded when they do not adapt to the norms. And mass incarceration is a form of excluding people from society. You know, you see it in all kinds of ways, but incarceration is, of course, a way of excluding people from society. They committed a crime and they have to be excluded. And they are judged. And it's not the crime that is judged, but it's the person that is judged. And that's a very... that's an evil mixing up, because the crime has to be judged, but not a person behind it. Because if you judge a person, he's paralyzed because he's judged. He cannot do anything anymore. You know, he's condemned. He's away. He's gone. But if you call, I do it even with my children. Never ever judge my child, but I. Of course, sometimes I judge the behavior he or the act he did or whatever he did, but never the person. And what you see in prisons is that the person is the same as the crime. It's the person behind the crime that has been judged. And you never, ever are allowed to judge the personality of somebody. No, never. Whatever he has done.
I think the saddest thing is when there's an individual who was never involved with the law, never involved with drugs or alcohol, never involved in trouble, being a troublemaker, growing up without a father, growing up without siblings, struggling and going to work and at the age of 13, struggling to get through high school, struggling to get through a year of prep school, struggling to get through 4 years of college, doing all these things, everyone respecting that individual, everyone liking that, being proud of that individual, and then to get into a one-time relationship that not only destroys an innocent person, but to destroy everything that person, the individual who committed the offense, struggled to achieve. And those people, the very people that were so proud, that were so liked this person so much, somehow forgot after that one offense, somehow forgot all the struggling, all the work that young man went through before falling, before being stumbled. And this person is like a million others in the prisons who have been forgotten, who have been judged, and are looked at as no more than an animal to so many people in the prison overseeing and those in the communities. That's a shame, because sometimes, again, it's not the individual, it's the cause, and people do not focus on that. If that individual committed suicide because of the pain and suffering that they were going through because of someone, if they committed suicide, it would not have been that individual who would have been judged. It would have been the person that caused that person to fall, to commit suicide. So people have to look at two sides. They have to look at every side, every situation. And again, it brings me right back to your book, to your philosophy, to your expertise, and the way you talk about the causes of an offense, whatever it may be. There are too many people in the prisons who are in prison for so many different reasons, but a lot of it goes back to a previous time where something went wrong, because no child is born bad. And this is my philosophy.
Exactly. And I think that what's very important to think about and to become aware of as a society is that a system like a prison system is a mirror of society. What you see inside the system is also telling something about society. I don't know if I have mentioned that example before, but I'm going to mention it again. It's about Norway. Norway is a very very aware people. And years ago, there was this man who was radicalized, and there was Andries Breivik. I don't know if I say it right. I don't speak Norwegian. But this man killed about 100 young people who were together. And this man got a life sentence. But a life sentence in Norway means that you have 25 years incarcerated. But in these 25 years, you get treatment, you know, as you also always mention. This man gets treatment, psychologists, etc., etc. And then after 25 years, they are going to check, they are going to test him, and they are going to see if this man has changed. If not, he's not going to be released, because then he remains a danger for himself or society. But he does get that second chance. When he has been rehabilitated, he can get out. Now, I saw a documentary. It was very interesting and very important, where in this documentary, the parents of these young people who were murdered were interviewed. And they also, a question was asked, what do you think about 25 years instead of real a life sentence? And they agreed with 25 years. They said, despite they were the parents of the victims, but they said everybody deserves a second chance. And very important also was, they also said, we as a society have to look at ourselves and try to find out how it is possible that this crime took place in our society, because the crime is also telling something about the society, and maybe we have to take lessons from it. Now, I realize it demands a very high awareness. I even don't think that the Netherlands is that far, but still it's a very clear example of that. When you look at mass incarceration in the United States, when people look at it, that they also look at themselves, because mass incarceration, locking up 2.2 million people inside the system, but also in a way locking up 2.2 million families, other loved ones, etc., etc., is possible because that society is arranged in a way that it is possible. And that's very important. The system does not, it's not an isolated system. It's embedded in all kinds of social issues, social parties, politics, economy, etc., etc. And that you cannot see it separate from each other. What is it? The way the people are treated inside the prison also says something about how people in the streets treat each other. And it's very important to really be aware of, because changing the system, abolishing the system, or do prison reform, or however you want to name it, also means changing society, and also means a change in the mindset of every individual.
Exactly. There's a case coming up, and I have to bring this up because this, you mentioned street. There was an individual who was home. He was in the military, actually in the Marines. He was an MP, and he was home on leave from the military. He was due to go back a couple of days after, before this incident happened. But he ran into some friends of his from high school. They were on their way to a party, and they asked him if he wanted to go. So he went with them. When they got to the party, his friend parked the car on the sidewalk, and they were walking up to go into the party when a group of other guys came out and went after them. Now, these were two races, two minority races, but not of the same culture. So this Marine and his two friends or three friends ran back to the car. They got in the car. Now, by this time, the gang of men that are after them are banging on the doors and the windows. And this Marine pulled out his weapon and shot it up in the air to disperse the crowd. But just as he shot the gun up in the air, his friend was driving off the sidewalk and the car jerked. And the gun went off into the crowd, and one of those individuals who was after them got shot and killed. This person ended up in prison with a life sentence. Again, he may be going up for parole. I don't know, because now they're talking about prison reform. They're talking about releasing prisoners who they feel are no longer at risk, et cetera, et cetera. But this is a clear example of what goes on in the streets. They were not the ones that created the problem, but because they were trying to defend themselves and an unfortunate accident happened, the wrong person went to prison where the others got away with it. But another individual was murdered, but the individual's mother wanted nothing but the life sentence for this individual that was just trying to protect himself. Another case of an innocent person that was turned and stumbled by another individual, and he's the one that ended up in prison. These are just some of the cases that we get in my organization. And it's unfortunate because there's so many innocent people or so many vulnerable people who end up in prison serving life sentences and life without for things that were not created by them, but they were the ones that, unfortunately, they were the ones that ended up doing the crime, and they ended up in prison for life or life without.
Yeah, and then what you see in these examples is that the circumstances where the crimes were committed are not taken into account. There's only the crime that counts, not the person not circumstances. While at the same time, we know that every act you do is always embedded in circumstances, and keeping making them distinct from each other. That's in fact not possible, but they do it.
It's a shame. It's a shame. There's an individual.
That also is a part of dehumanization. Not looking at the person. That's literally dehumanization. So it starts in court before conviction. Before somebody is convicted or not, it already starts with not taking the personality into account, not taking circumstances into account. And then you get people who did commit a crime. If you look at this man, a life sentence is crazy, of course. Life sentence and life without parole is cruel. That's a shame too. But what you see is that this man wasn't there. Only the crime was there. That's the only thing that where they are looking at, because the prisons have to stay filled.
Exactly.
It's all wired. Can you see? It's all these wires are all connected. The prisons have to stay filled, and that's an easy way. And then you have the bail industry, and then you have the plea bargain industry, etc., etc. It's all insane. It's crazy. It has nothing to do. Sometimes I think it has nothing to do with crimes, convictions, punishment, rehabilitation. It only has to do with money.
Exactly. There's an individual in Pennsylvania. He went to prison in the 70s. He came back from the military with all kinds of Purple Hearts, all kinds of medals of honors. This is a man that served his country. He came back, and back in the 70s when they had those demonstrations against the government, apparently a shot was fired in the crowd, and a police officer was shot. And this person was accused of the shooting and ended up in prison. Now, this is back in, I believe it was 1978. So we're talking like 88, 98, 2008, 18, 40-something years. And he's still in prison. Never involved with the law before. He came back from the military with all kinds of honors. And even though he served his country, even though all these things happened, he's been in for 40-something years for something that happened in a crowd during a demonstration. I don't know why people do these things, Mariam. I don't understand how people can be so vengeful, and retaliation is so great in this country that people are suffering way beyond the necessity of the importance of the crime that was committed. They're suffering more unnecessarily.
Yeah, but I think when you talk about retaliation, revenge, it says something about anger that is in society. Then again, you can think of the prison system as a reflection, a mirror of society. There is a lot of anger in society. When you look at the racial problem, why did black and white people never come to an understanding about each other? It's going on and on and on. When you think about all the shootings, then you have to step behind these shootings and the emotional story and think about the Second Amendment. Why do people want to carry guns? Why are they afraid? Because the more guns in society, the more shootings, the better the prisons get filled. And then what I told you, I think it was last week, about the intertwinement of economy and politics, that organization ALEC, who has influence on gun laws, but also in ALEC are organizations like the private prison organizations, Walmart, who sells guns, and etc. You see the intertwinement, and what you see on the surface are the sad stories. You see the victims of people who did have a gun, who made a wrong decision, but they could make that wrong decision because they had a gun. When I walk at my river at night here in the Netherlands, I don't need to be afraid because nobody here has a gun in my village. So I cannot shoot somebody because I don't have a gun. But I also don't need a gun because I'm not afraid for my neighbor because he also has no gun. What you see, and that's what you see in society, and you see again the reflection of the prison system when you think about violence, it's a spiral. It's a non-ending spiral. What you see in society is what you see with the guns. I buy a gun because I want to protect myself from another guy. But the other guy also buys a gun because he wants to protect himself from me. You know, where's the beginning, where's the end? There is no beginning and there is no end. So you get a lot more violence. A lot of violence on the street means prisons are filled. Filled prisons mean big business. What you see inside the prison is the same spiral of violence. Inmates get suppressed, oppressed 24 hours a day. Nobody can handle an oppression of 24 hours a day. You get crazy if you are in that situation. So one day you have to release all that oppression. So what happens? You become violent because it has to get out. A CO also is tensed because he is the one who has to oppress all the time. Very unnatural. So what you get is, at a moment, the oppression has to get out, tension has to get out, an inmate gets violent. A CO has a reason to oppress again, so he can become violent too. And then the prison says, see, we have to oppress because there is violence. You see, it's the same endless spiral,
which is not broken through.
It has to be broken through, and it's not happening. So it's action, reaction, 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 reaction in society and in prison. You see, exactly the same pattern.
You are so right. You know what? It's probably too late to do it now. But when you think about it, you go way back to ancient times. They didn't have guns. Like you say, in your village, there's no need for it. If only they would do away with the weapons completely. But it's too late now because it's out there. It's all over the world now. But there was never a need in the beginning. And the prisons would not be full right now if they didn't have weapons like that, guns. I mean,
and they were in the prisons.
Exactly. Marion, can you speak a little bit more on Alec? I know we spoke briefly about it last week when you were on, but can you talk a little bit more about ALEC that you mentioned last week?
Yeah, that's an organization. I did research to it, and ALEC, the letter stands for American Legislative Exchange Council, and it's a very closed organization. Just like the prison system, you know, it's very closed for the outside world. Journalists are not simply allowed in there. And it exists from, it's an organization that exists from members from the corporations and members from politics. And what they do, among other things, they make a part of the model laws, and it can be in the area of incarceration, but also education, all these social parts of society. They design model laws which go to the politicians and are often approved. So what we think is, when we think about laws, we think that they are made, designed by politicians alone. It's political. But they often stem from the mix of economics and politics. And a very dangerous law that stemmed from ALEC was, at that time, the Stand Your Ground law. I think it was first introduced in Florida. And the stand your ground law means normally you are allowed to shoot somebody when he is an intruder in your house. So you shoot somebody for self-defense. That's allowed in your house, on your property. But the stand your ground law extends this privilege. So if you walk on the streets and you have a gun and you feel threatened by another person and you shoot him and you say, this was self-defense, I felt threatened, then you don't get punished. What the danger is about this law is, and it has happened, that there is a lot of misuse, abuse of it. When I talked about it last time, I mentioned the example of that boy, school boy. He was a black boy. He came from school. He had a candy in his hand, and he was walking from school to his home. And there was a white man who was about, I think, in the 30s or 40s. He was walking behind that boy, and he shot him. He shot him, and he came in court, and he said, well, the boy made some strange moves, and I did feel threatened, and we came to a fight, and that's why I shot him, because and he pointed to the stand your ground law, and that man did not get a punishment. He came out, and he was not convicted. I must say that after that, those incidents, can I call it incidents? They were not incidents. Things have changed. A number of corporations withdrew out of ALEC, but it still exists. And it also, for me, it makes a lot clear about mass incarceration, how it exists. Because also what you see in mass incarceration is an intertwinement between of politics and economy.
Yes, really.
And I think it's important for that we are aware of that, the fact that laws not simply stem from politics, but also from economy. Corporations can design model laws when they are in the benefit of their own corporations.
Jeez. Alec, I never heard of that until you mentioned it last week. And I'll tell you, it really, really brings a lot clearer why mm-hmm. there are so many prisons for profits and so many other things going on where people are just paying, families of prisoners, paying for the phone calls, paying for the video visits, paying for package, holiday pack. I mean, everything is now money within the Department of Corrections nationwide. But I never knew about ALEC until you mentioned it. It's interesting to know and to keep it
yes.
in mind.
I think it's that's why I write it in my book, because I think it makes people think about what is happening behind mass incarceration, that these things keep it going. When you look at mass incarceration and you think about abolishment of this evil system, because that's really what it is, and I'm proving it in my book. I'm not just saying it, but I really have proof. I have evidence. Based proof that it is an evil system. To understand this evil system, these are very important aspects to be aware of. Because when you think of prison reform or abolishing the system, then you first have to start with asking who benefits from mass incarceration. Because the parties who benefit from it will not easily let go. And then you have to ask yourself, if I see in front of me, in my mind, another way of incarceration, like reopening hospitals, reopening forensic clinics, that's a better word, or incarceration that is fully focused on rehabilitation. Who are going to benefit from that? And I'm not only talking about the emotional part, because corporations don't care about emotions unless they can make money out of it. And that's what the world is. So we have to deal with this world. We cannot change this world overnight. So we have to see how would prison reform look like and who is going to benefit from it then. That's a way, unfortunately, but it is a fact. That's the way prison reform could be done step by step. But if we only look at the emotional side, we are not going to win this, because everything is translated into money. And that's because in the United States, democracy is based on neoliberalism. And that's the combination of economy and politics. That's how it's arranged. So you have to look inside your own country, how it's the country is arranged and what way of incarceration would be would fit in that society. You know, we can all look at Norway, but Norway is a completely different society with a different history, different culture, etc., etc. So even the Netherlands is not like Norway. Norway is perfect in that way, because it's a very aware country with an aware system completely based on rehabilitation. Completely, even the buildings, because that's where it starts. You have to think, Leon, about when I think about how the buildings of mass incarceration are built, who invented buildings for solitary confinement? Who invented and designed a shower where the temperature only can be arranged from the outside? That's designing torture. Exactly. In 2020. That's where it already starts. The buildings. I read this comment from a woman. It really touched me. Her son has been in solitary confinement for more than 20 years, and she said, "I never knew that there were buildings designed for this, and that there are architects who did a whole study, ready to design these kind of spaces, knowing that it's designed for torture." It goes that deep. It goes that deep. It's so, so deep. And we have to be, and it's not that prison reform cannot be done. It can be done. But we first start with being aware of all these things, because then you can change them. I used the metaphor of breaking down a wall. Now, here we can say it's a prison wall. But if you have a wall in your garden and you want to break it down, before you do that, you first have to look at how it has been built up, because you need the right tools to break it down. That's exactly that metaphor you can use for prison reform. Before you break down the system, you first have to know how it has been built up. Otherwise, you keep trying on the surface with little things. But you have to go to the foundation, to the roots. Where is it rooted in? And then it can be done. Why should it? Of course, it can be done, because one day mass incarceration has been built. And what you can build, you also can break down. So it can be done. That's the hope. That's a good message. It can be done. But it needs... it needs policy, time, and it needs the right steps and the right tools to do that. And it needs the awakening of the key figures in politics who are willing to do that. And they are there. They are there. They have to be supported, but they are there.
You know, I and so many others throughout this country envy your country and Norway, and all other countries that are so humane, because the facilities in your countries are nothing like the facilities in this country. And as you mentioned, we have to look behind who it was that created solitary confinement and created buildings, facilities like this. This is like, it's almost like a Hitler-type setting.
Mm-hmm.
where it was about really deep, deep vengeance, hatred. And this is what goes on. And I don't know why America, being the leading country of many countries, most countries, all countries, can be so cruel, so inhumane in their way of thinking, in the things that they do. I want to go back to what you said in the beginning about fitting in. I think we live in a country that has leadership. The leaders are so insecure that they feel they have to fit in by agreeing or going along with their peers. This is what's happening in this country, what has been happening. They feel insecure, so they have to agree or have the same mentality. When you listen to the media in this country, you have all these young people in the media who are supposed to be reporting news. They walk the same, they talk the same, they report the same, they laugh, they joke, they try to put all the focus on themselves. And they try to put all the focus on the same issue they spoke about weeks before and days before. So we live in a country that is full of insecure people. And it took a tragedy in my life, and it took me to travel 11 third world countries to realize I don't have to fit in with anyone. You know, I am me. And if people like me, they like me. If they don't, they don't. But everything that I stand for is justice. I despise lies and deception and corruption. These are all the things that have ruined my life, that have taken away everything that I worked hard for and everything that I stood for and everything that my loved ones stood for. People in this country have to get it together, and they have to realize they don't have to be somebody else's pet or somebody else's footstool. They can be themselves, and maybe they can teach their peers something. But we live in a country that's so insecure that they feel they have to go along with all this injustice that's going on. They feel they have to fit in. No one has to fit in with anyone. Everyone will want to fit in with them when they start showing their own strength.
Yeah, well, I think that incarcerated people also are a mirror for the people on the streets, because also many people on the streets have to remember who they are originally, what you say.
Yes.
And sometimes I say to incarcerated people here, when I have my sessions with them, there are more incarcerated people on the street than in prison, because they are imprisoned in themselves. They are trying to fit in, conformism. If you don't fit in, you get punished by exclusion. Exclusion is a very dangerous mechanism in society as well. You see, and also the reflection of incarceration. But also, you know, when I don't respond on social media, when I don't respond, conform the expectations of the group, then I'm excluded. You know, then I'm unfriended, or I don't get likes or whatever. A very important mechanism what you see is comparison, that we keep on comparing ourselves with the other, and then we have to become better. So we forget who we are ourselves, and that's also a reason why I work with incarcerated people. They are incarcerated, and they stand for the choice: are you going to remember who you are, or are you going further the way you did? And many people choose to go through that process, and that's the deeper justice process of remembering who they originally were. And I think it's a task, it's a life task, you know, that you grow towards who you are. And I even teach it my children. I always say that I don't lead my children, I follow my children. They are four individuals, four different people. They all four are from the same father and the same mother, but they are not my property. I am responsible for them, but they are not my property. So I always encourage them to seek for who they are inside themselves. And I always say, when you are born, you have a package. You've got a package with talents and all kinds of characteristics, and you have a whole life to open up the package and discover yourself in every phase again. And when you can do that, that's a process of becoming aware of who you are or remembering who you are, then you have a happy life. I think a person who lives according his own nature is a happy person, no matter who he is. When I always say to my children, when a flower opens up, he cannot change his colors, he cannot change his form, but he can only open up according his own nature. And it's the same with human beings. And that's also the process that's so much needed in prison. That's the true healing in the streets, but also in the prison.
You know,
for me, that's true restorative justice inside oneself.
The one thing I realize myself and for others out there, other parents, is that we should not try to protect our children too much about society. We have to let them know what's out there in the world. We can protect them in the home. We can protect them in the community. But once they, as you mentioned, once they get out there, they're on their own. So we have to also bring awareness to them while they're still young, what's out in the world. We can't paint everything as perfect out there. And they go out there vulnerable in the world thinking that everything is perfect. And then they hit all these corners, all these barriers.
Well, what I hear from my oldest daughter, she's 21. I was this week I was sort of walking with her at the river, and she told me, she's told me that many times before, that a lot of her friends who are from her age have parents who try to control them. They check their room, they check their telephone, they check their school bags, etc., etc. And these young people don't have room to develop themselves. And what I also see is that parents want to protect the children, but also want to control the children. They want the children to do it very good at school, because if the children fail, the parents feel they have failed. But if a parent then approaching the child in the benefit of the child, or only in the benefit of him or herself? You know, we have these issues here in our Dutch society that young people, children, get depressed because they are oppressed by the parents. Because if the child fails, the parents have failed. And then you also come back to that mechanism what you see in comparison. Parents compare their children. My children are much better than yours. You know, while I always say, my children are not perfect. They make mistakes. And what I told you last week, I had the police here in my living room because my younger son, he's 15, he stole a candy. So they are not perfect. They do things. But when I saw the police sitting in the living room, the first thing I thought, because I didn't get angry, I thought the police is angry and the shop is angry. I am not angry because he didn't steal from me, he stole from the shop. But I want to know from him why he did it, who he was at the moment that he did it, because he is normally a very concerned child, a responsible child. So I asked him, explain to me why you did it, how you did it, et cetera, to bring him to awareness. So the next time he's not going to do it again because he has learned from the first time. If I would have preached to him, I would have told him what he knows by himself because he knew already that he was doing something wrong. So those are things that make children being able to learn to know who they are. It's all the same process. And that's why I see in my house, my children are 15, 17, 19, and 21. They are four individuals who are discovering who they are. And sometimes they have to fall very hard because that's needed. And I always say to them, if I'm going to protect you, that's the same as what you said, Leona. If I'm going to protect you too much, then you are not prepared for society. And society is hard. it can be a great society, but it's also a very hard society. I want you to be prepared for what's coming. Not only negative, but also negative, because that part is there.
Yeah.
And so I see that they, you know, even when they have troubles, even when there are, things are not going right, mistakes are made, basically, deep inside, they feel happy. And it's a basic feeling of happiness, you know, and that's good. They feel senang, they feel confident with themselves. And I think that's the most important thing. And I, as a parent, I also make mistakes. I always make a joke to my children and they say, well, when you have my age, you have had your therapy because your mother was doing things wrong. Because being a parent is the most difficult job in the world, you know. But it's also the most beautiful job in the world.
I don't find it difficult. I mean, it's difficult when you have to raise children in society today. But I think being a parent and also being a friend to your children means a lot. To be able to talk, to be able to have talks. I remember my son one time asking me, you know, what I thought about something. I think it's an honor to have your children asking you, you know, things like that, what you think before they do something, before they get in, whatever. But sometimes we have a tendency to say, as long as you're happy. And that's not what we should be saying. We should be really thinking about a question. And we should really be giving an answer to the way we feel about situations. But I don't think it's as difficult. When your children, when you're doing a good job, when you're a good role model for your children, they want to follow. If you have a good job, they want a good job. If you're working in the medical field, they want to work in the medical field. Children want to be able to follow the good the parents are doing. Not to say that I'm a perfect parent. I mean, I had my problems. When I got my divorce, I got into drinking. I was a functional alcoholic for many years. But unfortunately, and I will say fortunately, because I was that way, my loved one was just the opposite. I smoked cigarettes back then. He didn't smoke. I drank back then. He hates alcohol. So, but a lot of times children will do exactly what the parent does. And other times they will do opposite of what the parent does. We don't know how it's going to go. We really don't.
No, of course we cannot look in the future. And what you mentioned, I think that's what I experienced here too, is that communication. That's so important. That's a key word, communication about everything.
Yeah.
I always say to my children, you can talk with me about everything, but you make the choice if you want to talk with me. So they come to me voluntarily, not because I demand them to talk to me. And then they come to me with all kinds of issues because I never judge. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's much, for me, it works much better than controlling my children. If I have to control my children and I have to, and I'm going to check them behind their backs, then they cannot trust me anymore. So instead of looking on the phone what they're doing, I talk about what's on the internet, what's dangerous, what are the good things, but also what are the dangers. And then we have conversations about it. And I believe more in open communication than in control and checking. And of course, sometimes it is needed to check or whatever. It's nuanced, you know. There are no, it's very nuanced, but that also makes it an interesting job to do.
I wish there were more psychosocial therapists in this world like yourself, Marianne. And I'll tell you why in a minute. But one of the things is I wish they had more of them involved as well. In the research, in the interaction, in the communication you have with the different prisons around the world, because this, I don't think I've ever met anyone, any psychosocial therapist, any psychologist, psychiatrist in the world. I have never met any of them that not only do the research, but not only, you know, try to figure out the causes of offenses, and not only stay non-biased. You have the complete package. You know, you're very unique. And unfortunately, we don't have enough people in the world like yourself. And if they had more psychosocial therapists working and trying to work on these issues with advocates, with others that are willing to try to make things better in the penal system, I think that there'd be more successes. Unfortunately, you're in the Netherlands, and that's why the Netherlands is succeeding in their prison system. We're in the United States, and that's why we're not succeeding, because I think the leadership in this country is so worried about making themselves look bad by taking the same views and doing the same thing that other successful countries are doing. And that's why it's not working in this country. They don't want to look like they're failing. But maybe if they started to look at Netherlands and France and Norway and places like that, I mean, Germany and places like that. Maybe if they started looking at some of the countries that are successful and following suit, maybe there'd be less incarcerations in the U.S. and less crime and less high recidivism rates. But they don't, I think, in the leadership in this country just don't want to admit that they're wrong. And that goes back to what I was saying about fitting in. They want to look like the big bad guys in the United States that oversees all other countries, when we are the failures in this country. We are the ones that are failing all countries. But I just appreciate you and I thank you. We have a couple more minutes, so if you can talk more about your upcoming book and some of the things that you want to see happen.
Yeah, well, I would like to, if you don't mind, respond short about what you said. I think that it has to do with the mindset, going from systemic thinking, labeling, to individual thinking, remembering who one is. I think that's the real basis, the foundation of what you see, what happens when people do approach the other person from the individual way, or approaching people from a systemic way. Well, these are the issues that I talk about in my book, and I am not ready yet. I listened to an interview with Barack Obama. He was talking about that he had written a book, and they asked him how he experienced writing a book, and he said something I very recognize very well. He said, "The best moment of writing a book is when it's written." It's a really big job. It's interesting, but you know, the subject is heavy, of course, because it's about deconstruction of mass incarceration. So going to the foundation of it, going to the social aspects of it, and I also make a comparison with what happened in Second World War II with the Holocaust, because the mechanisms are universal, and I see them back in both systems, and it's very confrontational, but I think it's needed that people get confronted with this truth, and it's evidence-based. It's not just something that I am thinking or what I read it in books. It's really evidence-based, and I hope I can contribute to more awareness in people who are connected to mass incarceration, and maybe people who have some influence in a possible reform of prisons. It's just my contribution to it.
Well, I thank you so much. I mean, you have been awesome. And I hope and pray that you'll be on with us again in the next few weeks, or whenever you have time. I enjoy listening to you all the time, and I know the audience will has. So, Mariam, anytime you have time, if you will, please let me know so we can have you back on again. And I thank you for being on with us this morning, this afternoon, this evening. What time is it in the Netherlands right now?
It's 4:30 p.m.
Okay.
I have my dinner. I have made my dinner for me and the children, and I only have to warm it up.
Well, thank you so much, Mariam. I really enjoyed having you, and I know the audience will benefit from everything that you have to say anytime at all. So we look forward to having you back on again, and we'll talk soon.
Okay. I like to return to the show again, and thank you, too, for a very nice interview.
Okay. We'll look forward to it in another week or so.
Okay, me too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.